This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
At the end of the table, John Husing. He's an economist. The Los Angeles Times named him one of the 100 most powerful people shaping life in Southern California. He's been, since 1981, the Vice President of Economics and Politics Incorporated. His clients include a lot of firms in the transport warehouse sector. He's an editor of Inland Empire Quarterly Economic Report, and he's going to talk about the impact of distribution centers on the economics and demography of the Inland Empire. Skipping over to our second speaker, at the other end of the table, David Benzman. He's a professor of labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers. His research is on American labor history, education reform, and the global economy. He's authored a number of books, Central Park East and its Graduates, Rusted Dreams, Hard Times in the Steel Community, and The Practice of Solidarity, American Hatters in the 19th Century. He's going to talk on the plight of the New Jersey port truckers. In the middle, Kristen Monaco. She's a professor of economics at Cal State in Long Beach. Her research interests include transportation economics and industrial organization. In 2004, Dr. Monaco, along with David Bellum and Taggart Books, published Sailors of the Concrete Sea, A Portrait of Truck Drivers' Work and Lives. And she'll talk about blue-collar logistics in the new Los Angeles. Our fourth speaker, Teddy Cruz, isn't here, but we will have a web-based presentation that Kim Yasuda will come up and do, and she'll tell us about Teddy when she comes up to do that. So with no further ado, let me turn it over to John Husing. Each speaker will have about 22 minutes, and we'll save questions till the end. John?
Can we make that work?
Technical person. Do we have a technical person?
Yeah, no, it's
just warming up.
Oh, there it goes. Good morning. I happen to live in the Inland Empire, which is San Bernardino and Riverside counties, the two counties inland in Southern California. And as a consequence of that, that area has the two main passes that come in and out of Southern California. Cajon Pass, which goes north on the I-15 and is the route that BNSF uses to get goods in and out of the state. And then on the 10 corridor, San Gregorio Pass, which is the I-10 freeway, and it's the Union Pacific route out. As a consequence of that, and the fact that there's an enormous amount of dirt located out in the Inland Empire that has not been developed, a good part of what's going on at the ports of LA and Long Beach ends up in job creation out in the inland region. And what I want to talk about is the significance of all of that. As I say, dirt is the critical factor here, and the way in which Southern California's edge communities have been growing up since World War II is a very defined pattern. First thing that happens is a bunch of developers who make houses go to an area that nobody in their right mind wants to live. They put up houses, and because they're affordable, people move there, and we have a massive amount of commuters and a lot of jobs that serve the population, but in fact generally don't pay very much. About a decade later, a different group of developers shows up, and they build industrial facilities. Back in the 60s and 70s, these were for manufacturing. Today, it's pretty much distribution, goods movement, because of the activity of international trade. They bring blue-collar area jobs to an area that up until that point was very much in job deficit. The last phase really doesn't deal a lot with what we're doing here. But there's a fact that comes out of all of this, and that is the distribution of people in Southern California, the use of the word sprawl, which is sort of the derogatory form for it, historically was thought of as being driven by freeways. In fact, I would suggest to you that if you build freeways, people are going to go out to areas like the Inland Empire. If you don't build them, they're going to go out there anyway, because the reason they're going is they want housing, and they'll put up with incredibly terrible lifestyles simply to be able to get into housing they can afford. When you look at the inland region of Southern California, last year the area created 48,150 jobs. That is more than the combination of San Diego and Orange County put together, and I would suggest to you that there will probably never be another year in which the two inland counties do not create more jobs than Orange and San Diego combined, simply because the dirt is out there and that is where most of the growth is now taking place. When you look at the forecast that's been made by SCAG, just to put that in perspective, the Inland Empire over a period of 2005 to 2020 is expected to add more jobs than the combination of Ventura and San Diego and Orange and Imperial counties, and alone more than Los Angeles County. Now, in that environment where you have lots of people going out essentially for affordable housing, one of the crucial things that comes out is the absolute necessity to have the blue-collar economy growing. And the reason for that is shown in this chart. This is the 2006 American Community Survey data from the Bureau of the Census. In San Bernardino County, 52.1% of the adult population has not had one college class. It is 50.9% in Riverside County. By the way, in Southern California as a whole, going out as far as Ventura and down to San Diego, it's 45% of the population has not had a single college class, community college, or anything else. So you have a need for upward mobility for blue-collar workers in that kind of an environment. Industrial facilities then become crucial, and as a consequence of where dirt now is in Southern California, in June of this year, 79% of all the industrial facilities that were being built in the two inland counties. The only other area of any significance really is LA County, which is 12%. That's mostly in Santa Clarita or up in the Lancaster-Palmdale area. As a consequence of the ability of the supply to grow, the price at which the facilities are leased for, if you take, say, a 400,000 square foot facility, which is a relatively average size, goes off for about $2 million a year. The cheapest alternative, which is in the area of Commerce and Vernon, City of Industry, is $616,000 a year more. If I have a company that is making 5% return on sales, which is incredibly good return, you'd have to have $12.3 million additional sales to not justify considering a site in the inland counties. The other thing that has happened is historically, the workers in the inland region have accepted less pay in order to keep off of the freeways and not be commuting into LA, Orange, and San Diego County. Those differentials have shrunk dramatically because the blue-collar economy of that area has become much more broad-based. Now it's a 2.3% differential between folks in Orange and San Diego County versus the inland, but versus LA, it's a tenth of a percent. It's basically now worked its way out. You do see that kind of a differential, but you see the differential now in white-collar much greater. Industrial absorption has soared in the region, even during the downturn in the early 1990s, you had 12.5 to 17.5 million square feet being of gross absorption going on in the two inland counties. It is now pretty much stabilized at 20 million square feet on a running annual average is what is being absorbed in facilities out there. This, despite building about 20 to 25 million square feet a year, the vacancy rate is only 4.8%, 8% being somewhat normal, which basically says to you, as fast as you're building it, you're filling it with firms that are making the decision to move there. As a consequence of that, it's a very large market today. It's approaching 400 million square feet under the roof, which is almost 40% of the size of L.A., which L.A. is the biggest accumulation of such facilities, I think, probably in the country. On the demand side, one of the things is the Cold War ended. The Cold War changed world economics. We said to the Chinese forever, communism is a dumb system, get rid of it. Unfortunately, they have now agreed with us, and they're beating us to death with our own system. The result of that is huge amounts of goods are now made in Asia. They get put into containers in Asia. They come across and are unloaded at our ports. A lot of them leave for the rest of the country by train. But a significant amount is coming to around the area by truck. If there's a person in this room that hasn't almost been killed by an 18-wheeler, I'm quite surprised. When you got to, in our area, those trucks end up bringing stuff on the right into distribution facilities, which are now quite huge. The most recent facilities are going off at 1,300,000 square feet under the roof. To put that in perspective, that is a 30-acre building under the roof, 40 feet high. When they leave the area, if they're on this side of the Rockies, if the destination, they go by truck out of those two passes I mentioned. If they are leaving by train for the rest of the country, there's an intermodal facility in San Bernardino, and they go out through there. They arrive at the retailers, and this is what we call today international supply chain management. The frightening thing in this particular area is when you look at port traffic. The red bars on this graph, ending with 15.8 million, are the number of 20-foot equivalent containers moving through LA and Long Beach harbors. The forecast, if the plans for expansion, as well as if what takes place with demand goes where everyone seems to think it's going to, you'll be at 42.5 million essentially in 18 years. Which essentially what you're saying is the volumes will triple going through the ports, and therefore you need facilities to be able to handle this. These two ports handle 44% of the imported containers and 25% of the exported containers of the U.S. That volume comes about in part because they're on the West Coast. It leaves Asia, bumps into the West Coast first. They are deep water ports. I laughingly say when I'm in Long Beach that Long Beach had a brilliant long-term economic strategy. They pumped the oil out of the ground and the bottom of the ocean sank, and they have deep water ports now that these big ships can in fact go into that draw 50 feet of water. They can't go into San Francisco Bay, the big ones, the 8,000 TEU ships. We have two competitors. They are Seattle-Tacoma, and they are the Vancouver area. But if you look at L.A.-Long Beach, it is double all the rest of the West Coast ports put together. They've got the best landside infrastructure for unloading. They've got on-dock rail. And the other thing that's going on out in that area is air cargo. And air cargo at LAX is where most of it is currently located. If you look at the 2005 number here at $294 billion worth of air cargo, it is anticipated to increase by fourfold. The result of that is when you look at where we currently sit, LAX is expected to go to 2.3 million tons. They're at 90% of that already, which means from there, it's going to go to other airports, and most of those airports are in the inland counties. Now, there are issues that jump out of this, and I'm going to talk about these issues for the balance of my presentation. Issue number one is clearly air quality. We need infrastructure to be able to handle these kinds of this kind of growth. You cannot handle it if you can't expand facilities, and you can't expand facilities unless, in fact, you begin to take care of the air quality issue. However, poverty is also a health issue. And the fact of the matter is, we need upwardly mobile jobs. So you have this sort of devil's choice. Welcome to the field of economics, which is what we're constantly dealing with. If you look at the kinds of jobs that people can go into with no education coming except high school, nothing beyond that, as I showed you earlier, look at the pay here and you can see the kinds of jobs that are available. You can go into agriculture, hotel, motel, retail, gaming. All of those areas are under 30 a year. When you get into construction and logistics and manufacturing, the average pay in those sectors is substantially higher. Mining is higher yet, except that's aggregate mining and it's a very tiny sector. When you look at the new job creation in the inland region, between 2000 and 2007, we have created 42,800 jobs directly related to international trade and what's taking place at the ports of LA and Long Beach, as well as what's going on in the airports. Freeway infrastructure, obviously an issue. How are you going to get stuff from the ports and LAX inland to where the stuff is being managed? One of the things that's been talked about is a dedicated truckways paid for by tolls on the truckers. Basically, however, what this represents is double-decking the 60 freeway from the 710 to the 15 and the 15 up through Cajon Pass and then all the way out through the Victor Valley. Rail movement is another key to this piece. You've got the Alameda Corridor. That's nice. But you've got all of these other routes. You've got BNSF going north all the way out through the Victorville area. You've got UP going all the way out through the Coachella Valley in Palm Springs. They happen to cross at grade in Colton, which means the trains have to stop because they are actually making a T-bone right there in that spot. High-speed electrified rail is a piece of what a lot of us are now thinking about. However, I think I just said $16 billion. And that is a crucial issue here. Intermodal yards are crucial. You need to be able to get goods on and off the trains, visa trucks. You've got an expansion now going on out in the Victorville area. UP, we can't figure out what they're doing. I don't think UP can figure out what they're doing, but ultimately they're going to need an inland facility as well. Grade separations are crucial for all of this. And the reason grade separations are crucial, very frankly, is the other day a train stopped in the city of Riverside, which is a north-south city, and divided the city in half for 6 hours. They had to actually drive out a new crew because they were stuck there for so long, which meant all the fire trucks, all the ambulances, everything in that city were trying to get around those trains. Land planning is crucial here, and this is an aerial view of the area of Ontario, and what you see there is LA Ontario Airport. You see rooftops. If you've ever landed there, you can almost land an airplane on some of these buildings. But notice there is nothing there but the kinds of facilities that deal with intermodal and with goods movement. There are no schools, there are no houses, there's no retail. It is completely isolated, which is a land planning issue needs to go on. Architecture is another issue here. The facilities being built aren't big, they're huge, they're gigantic. Stop and think of a 1,300,000 square foot building. One of the things that becomes crucial is architecture, because there's a time when these will be obsolete facilities and you want to be able to subdivide them. Putting it all together and summarizing, for our particular area, this industry is crucial, and the reason it's crucial is we need to develop jobs that allow people to have upward mobility into the middle class, and like it or not, the logistics industry is one that does that. I thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Our next speaker is David Bensman from Rutgers.
Thank you, Peter. I want to start out by saying that it's a great pleasure for me to be here because I'm here with a lot of people that I've learned a lot from in the last 3 or 4 years, and I'm also meeting some people from whom I'm learning a lot in the last couple days. I'm probably a little bit less prepared for this presentation than I might be because I've been so excited to be having conversations with people who know more about this than I do and who are teaching me so much. But for some of the people I've learned from, like Kristen Monaco, who's going to be speaking after me, Andy Herod, Mark Levinson, Paula Hamilton, all the people who've worked on the Coalition for Clean and Healthy Ports and so on. I want to thank you for all that you've taught me. I didn't start out intending to study the logistics industry. I was trying to understand why manufacturing employment was plunging between 2001 and 2003, but here I am, and it's been a great intellectual adventure. Previous speaker gave us the choice between lung disease or malnutrition, and I'm hoping that at the end of this process that we're working on together, we can figure out some better alternatives to that. And I met some really exciting people along the way who have been trying to explore some of those alternatives. Okay, so let me begin. The container revolution of the 1960s and 70s made possible the explosion of global trade and investment that began in the late 1970s and still is going on strong today. As Mark Levinson's book makes clear, the container revolution made it possible to bring down the cost of freight movement so radically that what had previously been insuperable barriers to offshore investment and global trade became manageable. For the past 3 years, I have been part of a research team that has been trying to understand how the growth of trade and investment triggered by the container revolution has impacted the labor markets of workers in the United States as well as in that of its business partners around the world. Not a small task, right? We decided that one way to illustrate the impact was to look at the labor markets of the freight moving industry itself, since that industry is surely one that has been most immediately impacted by the growth of global trade and investment. As we began to study the labor markets of the logistics industry, which is what I will call the freight movement industry from now on, I realized that the impact of globalization cannot be understood separate from the simultaneous global movement toward deregulation and privatization that was going on at the same time. Shane Hamilton's work adds some further historical depth to that, but I haven't fully digested that yet, so that's one of the exciting things that's happened at this conference for me. Indeed, if you talk about neoliberal globalization, that concept embraces both the rapid increase in global investment and trade and the deregulation and privatization that accompanied it. The story of the impact of neoliberal globalization on the labor markets of the logistics industry could be told about any of the industrial sectors involved in moving containers of goods, from the supplier plants at one end of the global supply chain to the retail stores on the other end. I could talk here about the labor markets on Indian or Chinese truck routes and railways, in Indonesian or Guatemalan warehouses, on ships flying the flags of Liberia or Panama or China, or on the docks in Busan, Rotterdam, or Cape Town. In all of these places, neoliberal globalization has brought about profound changes in labor markets. However, today I'm going to focus on the labor markets in the port trucking industry in the United States, mostly on the Port of New York and New Jersey, which is what I've looked at most closely. But with the help of a lot of the people in this room, I've also been looking at what's going on in the labor markets of Los Angeles and Long Beach and Miami, et cetera. So we've been in Port Newark and Elizabeth, where the container revolution got started. And I'll try to talk about some of what we've learned. If you visit any of the leading ports in the U.S., in L.A., Long Beach, Oakland, Seattle, New Jersey, or Miami, and you talk to the mostly men who drive trucks into and out of the port, you will hear a story of exploitation that illuminates how neoliberal globalization and America's 30 years old deregulation policy have combined to create destructive competition in low-wage labor markets. Before I started my talk, I mentioned to Nelson that I thought that John Zarolnik had said most of what I had to say yesterday, and Nelson said to me, well, just historicize it. So my effort at historicizing it would be like this. Just think of the 1870s and 80s. I think that's where we are again, in the midst of a revolution that has outstripped the society and the public's ability to control what's going on in the world around them, producing impacts on the public that are intolerable and which will raise loud public demands for some new regulatory regime. When a worker decides he wants to become a port trucker and participate in a trucking sector that collects $623 billion a year, or 84% of the total revenue collected by all transport modes, so it's a big industry, he will often go to a port trucking company to ask for work. If he has a clean driving record and a commercial driver's license, the company manager may suggest to him that they visit a truck dealer where the worker will be able to select a truck cab for his new career as an owner-operator. If he doesn't have legal documentation, the first step will be to buy fake IDs. The new driver and I've been told where you can pick them up in Elizabeth and Newark, and the cost is usually about $2,500. So once the driver has the identification, he picks out a cab, usually an old one, to keep down monthly payments, and he signs a lease. If he is unlucky enough to have landed in the hands of an unscrupulous or low-road trucking company, his boss will then take the lease back to headquarters. If his company is one of the better ones, the driver will keep the lease, and the burden of paying for not only his rig, but truck maintenance and fuel costs as well. From then on, this so-called owner-operator will independently contract to drive for the trucking company by appearing at the dispatch station every day to receive his assignment. He will receive a written order to pick up and deliver a container from a warehouse and bring it to the port, or vice versa, for a specified sum, which is based on the percentage of the rate that the drayage company or the trucking company has negotiated with a logistics service provider. But since the driver doesn't see the company's contract to haul the freight, he doesn't know if he's receiving the correct amount or not. The trucking company will deduct from his payment sums for such things as tire insurance and various fines and penalties for such infractions as returning a chassis in damaged condition or returning an empty container to the terminal later than the 3 days allowed. Sometimes he's paying more insurance money to the employer than the employer is paying to the insurance company. Sometimes he's paying for insurance that his employer hasn't even taken out. Because he is an owner-operator rather than an employee, there is no employer contribution to the unemployment insurance, Medicare or worker compensation funds, no Social Security tax, no health insurance, no pension contributions. The trucking company may require this independent operator to report daily to the dispatch office to await work, which means he can't seek work orders from more than one company. If he decides to leave one of the unscrupulous contractors, he will be told that he can leave, but the truck stays behind, so it can be assigned to a replacement driver. Since the lease has remained with the contractor, he has no recourse. Another common scenario is that a driver gets into an accident and only then discovers that the trucking company has not paid to cover him and his truck on its insurance policy. The cost of the accident may drive him into bankruptcy and or out of the trucking business. Okay, I'm going to step away from our owner-operator for a second. Two trajectories in the political economy of neoliberal globalization intersect to create this story of exploitation. First, there is the growth of trade, in particular the growth of imported goods from China. Since the Clinton and Bush II administrations agreed to support China's entry into the WTO, which was finalized in 2001, Chinese exports to the U.S. have grown from $102 billion to $300 billion, an increase of more than 180% in just 5 years. Not surprisingly, this surge overwhelmed the West Coast ports and forced shippers to begin sending goods originating in China through the Panama Canal to East Coast ports. The East Coast ports used to be almost entirely devoted to trade with across the North Atlantic to Europe and to the Caribbean. So this was a new phenomenon, pretty much. The East Coast ports were ill-prepared for the unexpected flood. Congested docks, jammed highways, and long delays along the nation's inadequate railroad tracks are the result. The explosion in imports might have led to soaring freight rates and rising wages for port truckers, had not deregulation, which is the second trajectory of neoliberal globalization, taken place in the U.S. beginning in the late 1970s. Carter-Kennedy reforms brought an end to the regulatory regime, which limited the number of trucking companies that could operate on each delivery route, a regime that set freight rates, a regime in which port truckers were union workers with health insurance, pensions, and industrial workers' wages. After 1981, most drayage companies ceased to be owners of trucks and employers of drivers. Under the new regime, most became brokers with few assets and even fewer responsibilities towards the drivers. Their role is to take orders and schedule pickups and deliveries from port terminals to distribution centers and warehouses, which, as we've heard, may be as far away as 75 miles from the ports, depending on distribution patterns, land prices, and labor costs. For their role in scheduling the truck movements of their contract drivers, they receive at least half of the freight delivery rate. In a generation, port trucking became a scene of destructive competition, which is, again, a phrase which I learned about in studying the 1870s and 1880s. It's a phrase, destructive competition, that faded out of the American vocabulary. But if you read people describing the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era, it's a and the Depression, it's a phrase that was used all the time. We've forgotten what destructive competition is. With virtually no barriers to entry, anyone with a phone and fax machine could become a trucking broker. There are now thousands of these brokers contracting with the somewhere between 50,000 and 75,000 owner-operators who constitute 70% of the drayage labor force. The rest are employees. Since these brokers have few, if any, assets or overhead costs, they constantly underbid each other, keeping transportation costs low, but shifting much of the cost of doing business onto surrounding communities like the ones that we just heard about in the form of dirty air, congested and broken roadways, and ubiquitous traffic accidents. As independent contractors, owner-drivers are treated by the law as independent businesses who have no collective bargaining rights,
as you heard yesterday from John, they have no power to join together to negotiate higher rates. In fact, drivers have been sued for violating the federal Sherman Antitrust Act, which was passed at the end of the period, the historical period I've been talking about, 1890. They've been sued for violating that act, for going on strike, or for demanding wage hikes. The low rate drivers receive do not allow them to maintain their trucks. The resulting high maintenance costs keep them from accumulating enough savings to afford to replace their aging trucks with newer ones. The newer ones provide better fuel economy and much less diesel emissions, but the drivers can't afford them. Lack of health insurance means that when a driver or a member of his family gets sick, the driver cannot afford to remain in a job without benefits. As tens of thousands of formerly Teamster Union drivers left the industry, they were replaced by workers with the fewest options. Immigrants from India and Pakistan and Seattle and Vancouver, from Central America and Mexico and California, from Cuba and Miami, and from Latin America, Africa, and Asia in New Jersey. Studies by researchers at the West Coast ports, one of whom is going to be speaking in a few minutes after me, shows that the driver's net pay averages less than $11 an hour without benefits for work weeks that it can exceed 60 hours. This is a wage level 30% below what union members earned when drayage was regulated. When you factor in benefits, the income loss exceeds 50%. I just want to talk a little bit about what it means to work 60 hours on congested highways and aging diesel fume spewing trucks. Because the daily experience is worse than what that sounds like, because port truckers are not paid for their time but for the load. The operators of terminals, trucking firms, distribution centers, and warehouses have no incentive to invest in technology or to streamline systems so that drivers can maximize the number of deliveries they make per day. Instead, drivers wait on lines to get through the terminal gates, to pick up the chassis on which their loads will sit, to exit the ports with their boxes inspected, to drive through bottlenecks at ramps and bridges leading to and from the port, to deliver and pick up boxes at the loading docks of distribution centers and warehouses. Waiting online, losing time, breathing in diesel fumes from old outmoded trucks leads to disabling stress, heart and lung disease, and cancer. But nobody knows how much, because no one has bothered to study the health impacts on these drivers who sit on the bottom of the American logistics supply chain. I understand that there is a study that the National Resources Defense Council is doing about the impact of these conditions on the health of poor truckers in Oakland, but that study isn't out. I've been talking to everybody I can think of in the last year about getting a study of the health impacts on drivers in New Jersey, because when I meet with them, it becomes immediately clear that there are terrible health impacts, but I haven't found anybody who's willing to pay for it yet. The fact that drivers are not paid for their waiting time takes a toll not only on their health, but on the efficiency of the logistics chain itself. Since their extra low earnings means that freight rates have remained low despite the rapid increase in shipping volumes, logistics firms have little incentive to invest in modern equipment to speed up the movement of the trucks carrying containers into and out of the port. In most of America's ports, the chassis which carry containers are old, and the traffic software which manages the flow of the freight and the trucks and the railroads is outdated. Freight rates are so low that it is economical for shippers to let their containers sit around at the terminal yards for up to 3 days, awaiting pickup and delivery. And some of the containers sit even longer, using the wharves as outdoor warehouses, accumulating late fees. These boxes take up space and clutter the yards, which also means that there are more accidents in the yards than there need to be. Because the freight rates are so low for the containers moving slowly through the congested terminals and highways, most customers don't insist on just-in-time delivery, for which they would have to pay a premium. At a conference last year, Nelson explained to me that Walmart does pay that premium because they want to have just-in-time delivery, but most of the companies in the U.S. don't do it because they find the cheap freight rates to be an adequate substitute. As a result, these shippers have higher inventory and insurance costs, and they lose potential profits when they have to discount items that arrived at the stores too late to satisfy customer demands. If they get the product when people are no longer willing to pay full price for them, they may have to sell them for a 50% discount, which is good for us when we go to Macy's, but it cuts into their profits. And I think that's another cost that you have to factor into when you think about how, when you're trying to calculate how inefficient the logistics industry is because of the weakness of the port trucking sector. The costs of destructive competition are borne directly by the public in two ways. First, drivers without health insurance have to rely on public hospitals for state-paid emergency medical care. The cost of this emergency care has been rising rapidly, causing state governments to cut back on aid to education, road repair, and housing. And second, the fact that trucking companies don't have to contribute to Social Security to make payments to workers' compensation funds or to make pension contributions intensifies the negative impact on public program budgets. Yet these costs are probably minor when compared to the costs imposed by the negative health impacts of heavy diesel emissions from tens of thousands of trucks with dirty, obsolete engines. In California, researchers estimated that the health impacts of these port-related emissions amount to $19 billion per year. And a study conducted by the New Jersey Environmental Justice Federation on diesel emissions in the ironbound section of Newark projected that by 2010, the cost of the health impacts on community residents from diesel soot would cost New Jersey almost $5 billion annually. Asthma, high death rates from cancer, days missed from work and school, high blood pressure, heart disease, these constitute the toll borne by residents of New Jersey's 11 counties. And if you look on a map, you'll see that those 11 counties that are out of compliance with federal air quality standard are right along the truck routes. The people in New Jersey, I don't really think, understand that their state is out of compliance with federal air quality standards, despite the efforts of the environmental movement to publicize that. In California, the destructive competition in port trucking reached such crisis proportions that residents of communities blighted by dirty air from ships, old trucks, and old diesel train engines organized to insist that something be done to clear the air. John talked about that yesterday. The resistance to the proposals to clean the air have been fierce, as you would expect. Logistics-related businesses are resisting the plans. They want the public to subsidize retrofitting of old truck engines, and they desperately want to keep Teamsters out of the ports. They are not only lobbying against the Clean Air Plan, they are threatening to tie up the reform process with lawsuits challenging the port's authority to set standards for port trucking. On October 23rd, the Bush administration weighed in, and I bet you could predict what they said. The Department of Transportation's Maritime Coordinator, Sean Connaughton, sent a letter to the director of the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach supporting the logistics industry's concerns about the plan to require that trucking companies employ their drivers, and he threatened litigation if the plans go forward. We haven't gotten that far in New Jersey. Environmentalists and labor and faith-based groups and community groups in New Jersey have gotten together to form what we call the Coalition for Healthy Ports. But we're just at the beginning stages of a process which in California has been going on for probably more than a decade. And so far, organizations like the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey haven't taken the concerns about the externalities of the growth of freight very seriously. Community and environmental groups are reaching out across the country to put excessive diesel emissions from dirty trucks and dockyard equipment and ships and tugboats on the agenda of the national movement to reduce greenhouse gases and meet air quality standards. So about a month ago, three community leaders from the Inland Empire came to New Jersey and asked someone from Change to Win to introduce them to people in the community who are concerned about the environmental impacts. The person from Change to Win called me, and I brought them over to St. Joseph's Social Service Center in Elizabeth, where they talked about how they had been organizing their communities. And the sister Jacinta at St. Joseph's and one of her young staff people got interested enough so that now one of the staff people is planning to come out here on November 30th to attend this conference. I think that before that meeting, the people in Elizabeth had felt like unemployment and homelessness were such profound problems in their communities that they weren't able to take the air pollution problems seriously. And I think they've just learned in the last few weeks that they need to take them seriously as well. This issue about how an unregulated logistics sector is affecting the public is starting to provoke national action. I'm just about at the end. Change to Win has made organizing the nation's owner-operators one of its five top priorities. In some states like New York and Illinois, the departments of labor are starting to move against misclassification. Patricia Smith, the commissioner of labor in New York, announced on May 3rd the creation of an immigrants' rights bureau within the Department of Labor to be staffed by 10 new labor standards inspectors who are proficient in Spanish and Korean. The bureau is liaising with immigrant groups throughout the state to ferret out the most egregious labor law violators. My conclusion is that the destructive competition of port trucking labor market is a vivid example of how neoliberal globalization's unregulated growth is unsustainable. And now there are efforts to put this issue on the national agenda. Progressive think tanks like Demos, the Century Foundation, and the Economic Policy Institute are beginning to ask whether it's time to put effective regulation back after 30 years of neglect. I want to end by saying that the California Clean Air Action Plan is a good example of what a new balance between the economy and the public welfare would look like, setting standards for the environment, for community accountability, for decent jobs, and for industry efficiency and sustainability. Perhaps more important, the fact that environmental, public health, labor, and community groups have been able to work together successfully to raise public awareness of the issues and to place them high on the public policy agenda is a model for how progressives can confront the challenges presented by the forces of neoliberal globalization and deregulation, which for the past 30 years have combined to degrade America's environment and labor markets.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks very much, David. Our next speaker is Kristen Monaco from Cal State Long Beach.
Advanced technology. I'm actually not going to talk at all about poor truck drivers today, which I hope isn't too disappointing, but I talk enough about them that I feel it's getting a little repetitive, so I wanted to do something slightly new, although I can answer any questions about poor drivers people might have. What I'm actually doing is sort of stepping on John's turf a little bit. He claims that he studies the ports of LA and Long Beach now because he started with the Inland Empire, is working his way to sort of the source of traffic. What I'm doing is exactly the opposite, starting thinking about port drivers at the ports of LA and Long Beach got me thinking about people working in logistics in the Inland Empire. Oh, before I go on, this research was funded by a grant from MetTrans, which is a DOT-funded transportation research center at USC. So got that out of the way. Obviously, there's a lot of issues that have been raised recently with respect to logistics labor markets. And sort of on one side, you have John and others who really advocate this idea that logistics employment is an answer to the decline of manufacturing. So as manufacturing has employment has declined in California, logistics is sort of the next best alternative, especially for the demographic we're considering. On the other side, you have this literature Edna and Goetz have talked about, which is this idea that logistics workers are underpaid. And I think the third question that's arising now, which is more of a public policy concern, is who are these workers who we rely on to move goods? And obviously, this is coming to the forefront now because of the transportation worker ID card, or the TWIC, which is going to be implemented at the ports any day now, according to Department of Homeland Security, which basically is going to monitor for both criminal background but also immigration status, which is obviously an issue with poor truckers. And obviously we're also interested in the demographics and economic performance of these workers with respect to the Clean Trucks program, which has been discussed. What I'm really here to present today is sort of some preliminary research, which is a very nice way of saying I'm not quite done with my research, so I threw together a bunch of charts to distract you from that fact. The data really looks at a source slightly different than John, so I'm looking at the micro data sets of both the 2000 census and the 2005 American Community Survey, which is also administered by the census. It's just a smaller sample size, but both are sort of nationally representative. And these are nice data sets because they have information on both labor market data, so wages, hours, industry, occupation, and the location of your job, but also demographics, gender, race and ethnicity, education, and the location of your residence. And these location issues I'm going to touch on a little bit more in a second. The goal is really to sort of take a stab at complementing or bridging existing research, which is this contrast between these are jobs that provide a lot of opportunities and this assertion that these are jobs that provide no opportunities. And I'm not really providing an answer to that, but hopefully providing some information that will help bridge this gap in the research. I think generally it's interesting to look at the labor climate, especially in sort of developing areas. And obviously in Southern California especially, there's a big move to think about environmental justice, which is as we're affecting these communities through development, how are the residents of these communities being affected? Is this a positive or a negative for them? I'm going to focus on the four county areas, so LA, Orange County, Riverside, and San Bernardino. Riverside and San Bernardino are otherwise known as the Inland Empire. and really want to describe, starting off, the distributions of jobs and residences. This is sort of, I think, relevant and important because when we talk about job growth, it's important to note whether the jobs that are being developed are actually going to the residents of the communities. We know the residents of the communities are the ones being affected by congestion and pollution and other negative externalities. The question is, are they also the ones who are benefiting from the job growth that's going on? Also want to just look at some basic economic indicators. This is from BEA data. Look at the distribution of occupations and industries that I'm going to call goods movement dependent or logistics dependent, which is really manufacturing, wholesale trade, retail trade, and transportation and warehousing. And then finally, look at the returns to education, which is a big issue. What are the returns to human capital investment in these industries? The first is just this table that my husband tells me is unreadable, but it's basically joint probabilities for where people live and where people work, and it sums up to one. But the idea is that there's this dispersion in Southern California between where people work and where people live. And I'm from the Midwest, so generally in the Midwest, people work where they live, right? And when I moved here and I got a job at Cal State Long Beach, I said to my boss, where should I live? He said, well, you could live in Long Beach or you could live anywhere else, because at the time, none of the faculty members actually lived in Long Beach. And I said, well, this is very odd to me. I thought you were supposed to live where you work. But in Southern California, this is obviously this divergence. And we're just looking at this at the county level. But what we see is that 90% of people who work in L.A. also live in L.A., and that number decreases as we go down. So only 55% of people who work in San Bernardino also live there. Okay, so 45% of the job creation is, in fact, going to people who live outside the area. And we get a similar sort of situation for Riverside. So in looking at this job creation, it's important to sort of touch on, are the residents benefiting? Where are the residents working? What kind of wages are they earning, et cetera? Looking at sort of stuff we know to be true, we know manufacturing in terms of GDP has declined. It seems to be rebounding somewhat. But we know wholesale trade is increasing in terms of our real GDP in the state. Transportation's relatively flat. Retail trade has grown over time. When we look at the percent of GDP generated by these industries, manufacturing relatively flat since early 2000, and a slight increase in wholesale trade, but relatively stable. Switching from GDP to employment, because I think what we care about in terms of job growth is obviously this employment issue. Manufacturing jobs are on the decline. We know manufacturing jobs are on the decline. But what's somewhat surprising here is retail trade, wholesale trade, and transportation warehousing have been relatively stable over the past 5 years, with the exception of San Bernardino County. And this sort of builds upon what John said earlier. This is where we get these job growth in these goods movement-related industries. If we look at the median weekly wages by occupation and industry, so occupation, our broad occupational categories are running down the table and industries across in the columns, we see that transportation warehousing in particular provides decent wages at the managerial professional level, right? So if the median weekly wage in manufacturing for managers and professionals is $1,250, in transportation and warehousing it's $1,000, which is fairly comparable, right? At the top end of the distribution, people who are professional managers are making what we would expect to be decent wages regardless of what industry they're in. What we see is a lot more divergence once we change out of those occupational categories to sort of less skilled occupational categories. Okay. What's important also is to think about how many jobs there are in each of these categories. So we see that overall, among everyone employed in the four-county area, 30.8% of all those working in the four-county area are managers or professionals of some sort. When we divide this down by industry, we see a very different pattern. So in manufacturing, 26.9% of workers are managers. When we move down to retail trade and transportation and warehousing, only about 12% of the workers are managers or professionals. Okay. There's a lot of people at the bottom generating the jobs at the top end of the distribution. Right? And this is something to think about when we start talking about upward mobility and how we move these people up, is that it takes an awful lot of people at the bottom end of the pyramid to feed up into the managerial positions that are available. And obviously your ability to move up and attain is really a function of your education. Hopefully that's the case. I have a bunch of students in the room, and I think they still believe that education is going to give them some kind of returns. We see, obviously, the educational distribution in LA. John mentioned before, we have a lot of people who are sort of at the high school level or below. About 20% of LA residents have a college degree, 8% have a graduate degree. In Orange County, we get the sort of demographic shift we expect, where we have more people at the higher end of the educational distribution. But when we look at the Inland Empire, as John said, we have a lot of people with a high school diploma or less. Okay, the overwhelming majority of the people who are working don't have a lot of education. Okay. If we look at sort of now the jobs by place of residence, again, the sample is the four-county area most people live in LA. The distribution for logistics industries is about the same distribution we see for all industries as a whole. So about 60% of people working in these good movement-dependent industries live in LA, 22% in Orange County, 12% in Riverside, 6% in San Bernardino. If we restrict our sample to people who are managers or professionals and look at where these people live, they disproportionately live in Orange County and disproportionately don't live in San Bernardino or Riverside. Okay, so they're sort of underrepresented. You know, what got me thinking about this is I teach in a master's program in global logistics, and the students who come out of there, they're professionals working in logistics, and they get these great jobs afterwards. And they make, you know, obviously a lot more money than I do, but, you know, that's the price we pay for being educators as opposed to sort of crane operators or logistics professionals. But the issue is they all wind up working in San Bernardino, but they don't live in San Bernardino. Right, and this is sort of the chasm we get here. If we look at handlers, people who are actually handling the goods in these warehouses and distribution centers, what we see is they overwhelmingly don't live in Orange County, and they disproportionately live in Riverside and San Bernardino, right? So this is sort of what we get. The lower end of the distribution is obviously handlers. So if we think of the two extremes, managers and professionals on the top end of the distribution and handlers on the bottom, again, these are people who are sort of loading pallets, driving forklifts, all the things you think about. The mean earnings are about $12.47 an hour. The median is $9.38 an hour. And when we get this divergence between the mean and the median, what this means is that there's a lot of people at the bottom end of the distribution, and we sort of see their weekly earnings. They comprise 5% of all workers in these goods movement-dependent industries, and 14% of all the production transport workers. 10% of all workers in the transport or warehousing industry, and again, 20% of all the production and transport workers within that industry subsector. So there are a big chunk of these workers. If we look at their demographics, we know why handlers don't make a lot of money. Handlers don't make a lot of money because they don't have the education, right? Again, most of these handlers, 44.5% have less than a high school degree, 34.5% have a high school diploma. So what, about 80% have a high school diploma or less. Almost none of them have a college or graduate degree, which, again, is good for my students because when they graduate, they'll know, hopefully they won't be handlers. They're overwhelmingly Hispanic. So if the percent Hispanic in the overall population is about 32% for the four-county area, 68.5% of all these handlers are Hispanic, and about 64.2% of them are full-time. And Getz talked about this yesterday. A lot of these are part-time workers. Returns to education. If we think about how you go from being a handler to being a manager and this sort of potential for upward mobility, obviously there's a huge education hurdle to get over, right? These people have a high school education or less. We need to get them trained up if we want them to move up the ladder. If we look at the returns to education, and the way I measure this is the percentage premium that you get for a certain degree versus less than a high school diploma, okay? So high school graduates tend to make about 31% more than people who haven't graduated high school. People with a graduate degree make 126% more than people who don't have a high school diploma. These returns to education control for all sorts of characteristics. So we're controlling for demographics, gender, race, ethnicity, occupation, all of these things. So these should be the pure returns to education. What we get is a fairly constant return to education in all of these categories, right? You can move up and you can get a return to these degrees, but you have to give these people access to education. Transportation and warehousing is, of course, the grand exception to this. You have a much lower return to education in this industry, right? There's this huge gap, especially, you know, college degree, graduate degree, you're not getting the returns in this industry that you're getting in other industries. Okay. So to sort of think about what my conclusions are, and I think I probably have generated more questions for myself than sort of conclusion, we know a couple of things about workers in these industries. Number one is, especially in transportation and warehousing, you have a lot of sort of support workers for every manager or professional occupation, job opening that you sort of generate. Managers in logistics are much more likely to live in Orange County than San Bernardino County. Handlers disproportionately live in San Bernardino County. Again, when we think about developing the Inland Empire and the jobs these are creating, what we want to know is what opportunities are these jobs creating for the residents of that community. There's a large educational differential, and the returns to education are lowest in transportation and logistics, which raises a bunch of questions, none of which I'm going to answer, but I think should stem some debate maybe between Getz and John or something. I'm not trying to set up fights, but, you know, it would punch things up a little bit. The number one question is sort of what's a reasonable rate of pay for logistics support workers, right? There's this idea that they're horribly underpaid and they're horribly exploited. And the question is, you know, if someone's making $10 to $12 an hour and they have less than a high school degree, is this a bad pay scale for them? Is this a reasonable pay scale? Where do we want them to be? How do we get them to sort of that point? What are the career prospects for entry-level workers in these industries? And I think this really involves looking at a lot of different data sets very carefully and sort of saying, if someone enters as, say, a handler, another sort of semi-skilled or unskilled occupation, what's the likelihood that they're actually moving up the chain here and becoming a manager and professional? And what are the returns for that? And then obviously, the big question is, what's the trade-off between job growth and congestion and environmental concerns, right? And this is sort of the pushback we're getting everywhere in Southern California, where we say, we need the ports to grow because the ports generate jobs, and people say, but the ports are dirty. And then you say, but they generate jobs, and they say, but we don't have those jobs. And so this is sort of the back and forth we need to think about. And as we get more job growth in the Inland Empire, more environmental groups out there are saying, you know, we're not happy about the increased congestion. We're not happy about the air quality. What kind of returns are we getting when we incur these costs? And then the final question, which I think John presented as well, which is, if we're not doing it in the Inland Empire, where are we going to do all this goods handling? Keep in mind, a big chunk of what comes in through the ports actually stays in sort of the Southern California region. So there's only so far east we're going to be able to push before stuff starts coming back west. Okay, so those are my questions. I have no answers, but maybe we can have some nice discourse on that.
Honestly, the answer was proposed, Shane Hamilton at the University of Georgia, was proposed by Joseph Eastman, who pushed for the Motor Carrier Act of 1935. What he originally wanted was actually let the octopus be. You know, forget all this concern about monopoly. Let's have one giant transportation monopoly that is carefully regulated by, you know, federal oversight that will create efficiency. So we can have railroads, we can have trucks, we can have multiple modes of transportation which are used efficiently, the way that Walmart, you know, has this kind of octopus-like control over its distribution networks. You know, use government oversight to make sure that there is an efficient transportation infrastructure. But of course, you know, the railroads were not particularly interested in having their operations watched that closely by the ICC. Truckers very much wanted a different kind of infrastructure. So regulation itself was always broken up into preserving these inherent advantages, as the 1940 Transportation Act put it. So whether that was ever a legitimate alternative, who knows? But, you know, we are facing a world in which, you know, containerized shipping is this seamless, you know, the mega octopus, there is a chance for powerful players to actually create the kinds of efficiencies that would demand that, you know, time be a disciplined commodity in terms of these truckers, you know, rather than letting them just sit there with a load, wasting fuel, which is getting increasingly expensive, wasting their time. You know, there could be big players who actually take control of the entire system, whether it is Walmart or, you know, the other retailers who have the pull power, or if it's, you know, these distribution companies. But, I mean, you pose the question whether there will be a push for re-regulation. And I'm curious whether you think that actually is a legitimate possibility in the future, that there will be some groundswell, you know, like the Granger movement of the 19th century calling for taming of this octopus.
Well, I guess when I look at what's been happening in L.A. and Long Beach, it looks to me like that's the beginning of something that, because, I mean, something like 6 years worth of modernization and expansion activities at the ports in L.A. and Long Beach have been put on hold because of the demands of the environmental community and concerns about air quality. And I right now I'm looking at that as possibly the leading, you know, edge of a movement to regulate in the interest of preserving the environment and public health and so on.
In that light, I might add that at LA and Long Beach, one of the interesting phenomenon that you run into is that a large number of the trucking companies in fact want to see greater regulation of who gets to go in and out of the gate, because they recognize that effectively perfect competition, which is what we have, has been a race to the bottom, and they see some regulation of the industry, which in effect raises their costs, as making it more difficult from what they term the bottom feeders to be in the market, because they won't be able to afford to be. So that there's actually on both sides of the table there some interest in the same outcome.
Just to jump on that real quick. I think one of the issues talking about what's going to happen with the Clean Air Action Plan and the number of trucking companies, as you actually shrink the number of trucking companies, there are potential for efficiencies there. A lot of the waiting time is because the terminals don't have the container ready for the truck when the truck pulls up. And this sort of idea that you have hundreds of trucking companies with thousands of drivers all showing up to look for one specific container, when most of the containers are going to the same place anyway, is a little odd in you know, sort of a perfect world. A truck driver goes there, they pick up the load that's ready, and they take the load that's ready where it's supposed to go. If you had fewer firms, you could have a lot more sort of coordination between terminals and trucking companies, which is lacking right now.
If truckers were like cab drivers, you would eliminate a lot of the waiting.
Over here. Yes, Mark Strauss, FX File Architects and Planners. I'm an architect and planner who's been working significantly with industrialized properties that are moving towards redevelopment from generally speaking, waterfront properties that have been being developed for commercial uses. And I'm wondering, from a land use point of view, if maybe our communities are moving too quickly to eliminate these industrial areas that are no longer working for industrial purposes. And I'm wondering if part of the problem from an environmental point of view with regard to the shipping industry is that with that we have too much concentrations in too few locations, and that maybe that if one were to really make use in a larger way with regard to the industrial landscape and not try to keep narrowing it, there might be more opportunity for more locations that can serve the transportation industry in a way that might create more efficiencies, so you wouldn't have all the waiting time in these locations for the trucking. Is that something that anybody's looking at in terms of expanding the locations for these kinds of ports in order to create more efficiencies?
What I'm observing, which kind of goes along with what I was saying in my presentation, is that the sizes of the facilities, because of the technologies used inside the buildings, has been growing almost at an exponential rate. When I first started studying the Inland Empire, a 100,000 square foot building was regarded as enormous. We now have, that I can count, 7 million square foot plus buildings under construction. The amount of dirt that that requires, because of the kinds of technologies inside the buildings, really almost obviates putting them in the coastal counties because land is just too expensive. And its highest and best use is for something else. That, of course, creates the transportation issue of how the heck do you get the stuff from the ports inland? And that's the $40 billion question that we're all trying to face right now. And a lot of what we're thinking about, quite frankly, is it's going to ultimately have to be a user fee basis, probably using container as the source of the revenue, with ultimately industry's opposition dropped if, in fact, they can see a bottom line because of efficiency of throughput and reliability, which is showing up in our system in Southern California now, but before this is over is going to show up in every urban environment around the ports in the United States.
Actually, the question makes me want to add something, which is I think that the fact that the Inland Empire has been growing is obscuring the fact that the logistics industry is looking for lower cost, less regulated alternatives. And so Prince Rupert in Canada, Savannah on the East Coast and Norfolk are getting lots of new capital invested because people are looking for places where the land is cheap, where the environmental regulations aren't strong, where labor is cheaper, and where they have less congestion. And so, you know, I think there probably will be a lot of reconfigurations. And another thing that we should add to that was mentioned yesterday is that in many cities, the developers and the city governments are deciding they'd rather have the coastal region be developed for high-cost housing rather than for commercial purposes, and so they're driving out or limiting the growth of the ports.
Okay, we'll take one more, and then we'll wrap it up.
John Zrolnick from Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy, and at the risk of belaboring this discussion of port trucking, I did want to address a question earlier about the status of the LA Long Beach plan, because we've obviously been doing a lot of work on that at Lane and through the Coalition for Clean and Safe Ports. What has been recently passed in the past couple weeks, and you know, John referred to it as, you know, as a full package, and I would slightly disagree with that. I would also say at the outset that a lot of the work that John has done on this point through his economic analysis report that came out recently has been phenomenal and very useful, illustrating really clearly how it is a failed market and how the marginal costs are very easily absorbed. But what was passed recently is not a comprehensive package. It's essentially these tariffs, these rules that the ports have separately adopted, are a restatement of goals. You know, by this date, we want these trucks gone. By this date, we want these trucks gone. It contains nothing about how to actually sustain, as David mentioned, such a program, nothing about how to, you know, prevent the crisis from reoccurring, and it doesn't address the thrust that I was trying to make yesterday, that you can't separate the environmental impact from the economic structure. John did say that by the 12th, by the 14th of December, the ports have stated that they want to come back with a full package that would address all of this stuff. They have not yet, and if they don't do that, then what was recently adopted is going to be just another press release, and we're not going to see the improvements that are desperately needed on both the environmental and public health side and the economic side for the driver. So there's still a lot of work to be
done.
That's
very accurate. I agree with that.
Just to stir up the pot a little bit more, because there is this issue of the difference between altering the environmental regulations and altering the labor landscape. John was giving me some interesting information about truck driver preferences this morning, and I think this is an issue that a lot of people have been curious about. If you mandate that these truck drivers become employees, how do the truck drivers feel about this? What is their reaction going to be? And does this take opportunities away from them as sort of entrepreneurs? We know truck drivers get a return to their investment once they've paid off the truck. Under an employment model, they don't get that return. And so there have been a series of sort of questions about whether they're interested in becoming employees. And maybe John wants to just give a little blurb on that.
Well, it starts with your work and then transitions over to our work, because Kristen and I have both worked on this issue, and it also has had work from Change to Win looking at this issue. And what we just completed, I didn't do it, my affiliated firm that's also working on this stuff did it. They interviewed truckers back in the summer and then again a little over a week ago, and asked the question, if you were paid $20 an hour, and you had the package of state benefits, workers' comp, disability, Social Security, and if there was driver-paid insurance, would you be willing to become an employee as opposed to an independent operator? And then for those who said no, the follow-up question was, all right, we really don't believe you. Do you have an alternative strategy? That is, do you have something else that you say you would do if, in fact, the port said you must become an employee to come through the gate? The results are startling and difficult to understand. And I was talking with Change to Win, one of the gentlemen the night before last. 50% said no. And of that 50%, only about 6% did not have an alternative strategy that they indicated they would go to. Now, I don't understand that answer. But if we then weighted it by throughput, which is one of the issues you constantly have to worry about, is whatever goes on at the ports, you want to have, when it's all said and done, still have the cargo moving, because it's a huge impact on the economy, in excess of 1.3 million jobs in the southwestern section of the U.S. So it's hard to, when we weighted it by throughput, it came out to 65% of the throughput said no. Now, I don't know what to do with a result like that, because do I believe it? It is consistent with the answer we got in the summer, and it's consistent, I believe, with the work that Kristen has done. So we keep hearing this. And it just doesn't square with what you had to say, but it is what they keep telling us. So I don't know what to do with it other than that's to report it.
Can I say something? All right. This relates to the historical work I did about craft and consciousness when I studied the hatting industry. You know, I do believe that the owner-operators think of themselves as pirates of the highway. They have a very independent mentality. They want to be entrepreneurs. They think that somehow they're going to figure out how to game the system and make a lot of money at it. I've thought about this the way John and talked about. I don't think that they have a realistic plan for how they can achieve that goal. And I when I realized how deep their attachment was to that occupational identity, I thought long and hard about what was going to happen when the Teamsters came in, but I realized that, you know, without the pressure from environmentalists, there was no hope of changing the port truckers' jobs, and the input from the environmentalists was only going to be effective if it was in conjunction with the union and turning the job into an employee job. I don't see any other way of helping the truck drivers get out of the bind that they're in. So, you know, I can't guarantee that they're going to end up being union members, but I just think that this is the only way that their conditions can be improved.
Thanks very much. It's been fun, but we're out of time. Please join me in thanking the panelists for a great session.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.